Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome back to the EPL Roundtable. I'm your host, Kevin DeVries, and as always, if you'd like to reach us at the podcast, you can do so by either tweeting us at EPL Roundtable or emailing us at eplroundtable@gmail.com.
Hi guys, I'm Jim. I'm the Leicester City representative for the EPL Roundtable. You can find me on Twitter at Jim988.
Hello, my name is Gitto Llewellyn, Swansea City fan and contributor to the Jackcast podcast.
Hi, I'm Jay Cream. I'm editor and founder of the EaglesBeat.com, a Palace fan site by fans for fans. I'm also host and presenter of a local community radio show, the Meridian Sports Show. You can get us on Twitter there as well, at MeridianSS.
All right, thanks so much for joining us, guys. One of the things I've noticed this weekend is that Manchester United look very, very scary. Gone are the days of just the plodding football that happened the last Van Gaal year and largely Mourinho's first year last season. The attack seems to be incisive, as Gitto, I'm sure, witnessed and did not like. But the defense still seems solid. Matic has really seemed to free up Paul Pogba. How well do we think that they could do this year? And are you also worried about this development?
I'm a little bit worried for when they play Leicester, because we're not particularly good at defending, so we're going to get torn to pieces. It's difficult because I expected Manchester United to be really good and went on the record to say they were being really good when everyone else was saying that City were going to walk the league. So I'm quite happy in some ways that it's not happening to Leicester, but it's happening. But I do fear it when they come to us. Obviously, we're playing them next, and you know, that's a kind of scary trip at the moment, thinking about how we defended against Arsenal. Combine that with their attacking force, where seemingly four goals is the minimum they expect now, and it doesn't particularly bode well for us going into next Saturday.
It's obviously early in the season, but when a team scores four goals two games in a row, obviously it sends out the message, and I do think now they're ready to make a title challenge again for the first time since Fergie was there. I don't actually think they were particularly bad last season. They were difficult to beat. They were just wasteful in front of goal, and they didn't quite click in the way that the teams above them did, which is why they did miss out on the top four. But they just those little problems look to have been ironed out. I think they've found a role now for Pogba, which is going to get the best out of him. I think Lukaku is a good addition. Matic just frees up all of these more attacking midfielders to be a bit more adventurous. It's just these little problems I think Mourinho's now been able to iron out. I think the rest of the league should be a little bit worried, if I'm honest, because they looked pretty strong yesterday.
Completely agree with you guys. They looked ominous in the first two games already. Four goals in each game. You can't ignore that at all. I'm just looking forward to Palace having to play United and City in consecutive weekends away from home, which will be fun. 7 days, I'm sure, the way we're playing at the moment. But United, yeah, I was very similar in pre-season, thinking that, you know, the way that Mourinho's gone about his business, obviously, you know, the big fee for Lukaku, I think that was probably a missing piece for United, with the absence of Ibrahimovic, you know, after his injury last season, which was a real shame. Pogba, I think, is going to have a massive season. You know, with Matic in there behind him now, he's not going to have to be quite as defensive as he was last season. All the talk has been about City and how they've strengthened their team, but I think Mourinho has done a superb job. And like Gutto just said, that United didn't have a particularly bad season last year at all. It was just Mourinho getting used to the squad that he had, the personnel at his disposal, and just knowing who to get rid of, who to use, at, you know, in the right positions, and do it. And he's doing what what he's done in previous years with clubs, and it'd be interesting to see how it pans out towards the end of the season. But they're going to be right up there challenging for sure.
Oh, that's a good shout. Are we thinking they are the far too early to announce title favourites? Should we see City first again?
Yeah, for sure. But I think it's going to be a lot more interesting than last season was. I know there was, you're talking about, you know, teams, the top six sides in the country really reacted to Leicester winning a title, and last season was kind of a, you know, a shoo-in for all those sides, just a battle out between them, and you look how far ahead they finished from the next side. And I think this is going to be similar, but yeah, all the top sides, or most of the top sides, I would say, have strengthened and spent an awful lot of money in an effort to you know, to win that title. And I think, you know, two Manchester clubs look quite ominous at the moment, for sure, but United have started fantastically well.
All right, another thing that happened this week was this proposal for the transfer window to end before the season starts. My quick opinion on it is that it would be problematic if the FA was the only league to do it. It feels like it would need to kind of be a UEFA-wide thing, I think, for it to work the way people would like it to be. But what do you guys think about it?
Yeah, I'd agree on that front. I think it would have to be adopted by everyone in Europe, because otherwise you're going to have clubs that are having to do their business early and then still potentially at risk of having, you know, other clubs kind of sniffing around their players as the later deadlines approach. In terms of getting it done before the season is starting, I think it would be good because it would force people to get their business done early, and then we wouldn't have this kind of uncertainty. If you look at a lot of the bigger players around the Premier League at the moment, Coutinho, Virgil van Dijk, we've obviously had the ongoing situation with Gylfi Sigurdsson at Swansea. Even this week, you know, Chris Wood put out a note on his Twitter saying he wasn't in the right frame of mind to play for Leeds United this weekend because of a potential move to Burnley. And that's just not what fans want. You know, being you know, a Leeds United fan going to that game, obviously they won 2-0, so that helped. But going into that game with Sunderland, a team that you'd expect to be potentially up there, and your main striker, the guy that got you 25 goals last season, and you know, you'd hope to lead your promotion charge, says he's not in the right frame of mind because a Premier League team have come knocking at the door, is, you know, is frustrating at the very, very least for fans. And ultimately, you know, they're the ones that miss out because they don't see these star players, and they're all unsettled, they're all injured, seemingly with bad backs or slight niggles from the summer that will miraculously clear up, I'm sure, if they don't get their moves on September the 1st. So yeah, it's a frustrating time. It also stops clubs kind of planning ahead, I guess, because they have to have this contingency, and it just drives more and more astronomical transfer fees, because as soon as a club come and buy your best player, say Coutinho does leave Liverpool for Barcelona for 130 million, every player that Liverpool approach to try and replace him, they're going to have another zero added on to the end of their price, because every selling club knows that Liverpool have got less than 2 weeks to do their business and are flush with cash from the Coutinho deal. So what was an initially, you know, a 30 or 40 million pound valuation goes up to 50 or 60 potentially, just purely because they know that they've, you know, it's a seller's market. They've got the asset that Liverpool want, and Liverpool have got the money to pay them because everybody knows the transfer fees are so public. So it's a frustrating time, and I think a lot of managers will probably be in support of it. I don't really see it being an issue with getting it through Europe-wide either, because I'm sure every European manager is probably in the same boat. You know, Barcelona had the tables turned on them at the moment, but now they're feeling the pinch trying to replace Neymar. Even a club of their stature is struggling to get deals done. So if that happens to one of the biggest clubs in the world, I'm sure, you know, the relatively smaller clubs would probably agree that it's probably a good thing to get it done early doors as well.
Is anybody else here surprised that so many Premier League clubs are said to be in favour of it? Because if I'm Liverpool and, you know, Barcelona chasing my star player, the last thing I want is for them to have a couple of weeks extra where they can purchase Coutinho, but Liverpool can't buy a replacement. It seems to me it just puts Premier League clubs, the biggest Premier League clubs in particular, at such a disadvantage compared to other big European clubs. It's surprises me. I read one article saying that only Watford are likely to vote against this decision. That surprised me a little, I'll be honest.
I think Palace as well have said that.
Really?
Yeah, against it. I mean, yeah. There's an interesting interview with Steve Parish today that he talks about quite a few things, particularly a transfer market, and kind of back on point about the transfer window. In theory, it would be great if the transfer window finished a week before the season started, because I think that kind of ends everything, and you know, players and teams and fans in particular can enjoy looking forward to their team, because we're missing out on the likes of Coutinho playing at the moment, the first two games. Is it Barkley? Is Barkley injured, or is he just out of favour? And you know, Sigurdsson hasn't played either, you know, until obviously, you know, he might play tomorrow. Because of the ridiculous situation with the transfers, and you know, the whole fact that a Neymar deal has happened, and it's inflated everything. And it's something that Steve Parish alluded to on the radio earlier on, in that, you know, it's so hard to do a deal for clubs that are, you know, in the bottom half of or outside the top six or seven clubs in the Premier League, because everything is so inflated. Both wages and transfer fees have gone up, and it's just really hard to do deals. And he didn't actually explain his reasoning behind why he's not in favour of ending, like changing the transfer window. He didn't actually go as far as to say that. But another point which was interesting that he made was about how clubs are getting around the FFP rules, because with so much money being spent at the moment across Europe, across the country as well. And his view is that, you know, a club like Palace have to cut their cloth accordingly, and to try and stay within the rules, you don't want to be fined or face a transfer embargo, which has obviously happened. Transfer embargoes happen to bigger clubs in Europe, but you know, clubs like Palace and, you know, other clubs similar to us have to make sure they do things in the right way, whereas everyone else seems to be shelling money left, right and centre. You know, big wages, big transfer fees. You know, City have spent, what, $250 million on their back line. It just seems that everything's just completely gone out a window, and the rules don't seem to matter to clubs anymore. I'm not quite sure if that's quite a truth, but whether clubs are happy to just take a fee, take a hit, or take a transfer embargo, whichever, if they break the rules, then you know, seem to be happy to do that. But it seems a really crazy situation at the moment, and particularly the Neymar deal has kind of inflated everything. I'm not a big fan of the transfer window at all. I'm not sure how it should be changed. January transfer window is crazy. I think that's just media generated completely, because it just, everything goes up a notch from like the 1st of January for the whole month, and it just builds up to the end, and then you've got a countdown clock on the end of the transfer deadline day. I'm not a big fan at all.
Yeah, it has definitely become more of a circus than an actual big thing, especially deadline day, as you mentioned, has become more of an event than an actual day on which a lot of deals are made. Usually people are largely done by that time, and we've had a few very boring deadline days in the past few, but nonetheless, still the dramatic music and everything like that. We talked about Coutinho there and his situation. We're just going to go through a few players and ask if you would rather have the fee or the player. If it was your club, we'll start with Liverpool. Would you rather have 120 million or Coutinho?
120 million all day. I don't think he's a £120 million player.
Even in this market?
I just think it's a knock on from Neymar, though. Kind of getting a replacement in is going to have that knock on effect as well, as I said. But it's just, that Neymar deal is an outlier that's going to throw every other major transfer off potentially 20, 30, 40 million pounds, because everyone will look at Neymar and use that as the denominator to say, well, if Neymar is 222 million euros, then how much is X? And it's like, well, maybe Neymar isn't it 222 million pound player. It's just that PSG wanted a statement marquee purchase. His ludicrously high release clause was 222 million euros. And so that's what they had to pay. Those kind of fees are in there to kind of put off clubs. And it just so happens that PSG have said, right, we don't care about UEFA's FFP rules. We're just going to buy this player because we know we can get him for that money. So that's just going to have a knock-on effect for everyone else now. We were looking at, you know, the world record for Pogba was 90 million last year. And we're now looking at that being doubled, more than doubled for Neymar. And then every single player that goes in that chain after that is going to be more than that. If Ousmane Dembele goes from Dortmund, he's going to be more than Pogba was a year ago. It's insane. But yeah, I'd rather have the 120 million than Coutinho personally.
Me too. I think 120 million would be good money for Coutinho. I think, obviously he's a brilliant player, but I don't think he is among the very, very best in the world in his position. So a lot of Liverpool fans would disagree with me there. But if you look at just the other so creative midfielders, number 10s in the Premier League, I think he falls just tiny bit short of the very best in the league. And if I'm honest as well, I don't think Liverpool would miss him as much as some people think they do. I think they're okay in attack generally. Obviously, it's a blow losing a player like Coutinho, but they have players who can help compensate for his absence. It's at the back, really, that they've got their problems, not going forward, as they've proved, really, in their first two games.
I agree with you guys. 120 million, no-brainer completely, but I completely see where Liverpool are coming from, because at this stage of the season, or start of the season, it's a really bad time to lose such a player. You know, if it was in the middle of the summer, then it might have been a different story and they could have planned for to bring somebody in, but it doesn't give them much time to bring somebody in. I mean, I guess if they'd have accepted the first offer, then you know, they'd effectively had a couple of weeks to bring somebody in, but we know how difficult that has been for clubs. I mean, Barcelona haven't replaced Neymar yet, and that's a club of that stature after that massive, ridiculous deal. So I completely see where Liverpool are coming from, whether they're just pushing it to get more money, but then they're not leaving themselves much time to kind of replace the guy. But I kind of agree. I'd take the money for him, but it's a really difficult stage of the season, I think.
Yeah, I think this may have gone differently already if Lallana was going to be fit anytime soon. For better or worse, I'm not sure Lallana can fill that role for them long term, but Klopp sure seems to think he could. And I think that may have changed things a little bit, but agree, I would rather have the money as well. Gitta, we'll start with you on this next one because it is very fresh and appropriate for your club. 45 million or Gylfi Sigurdsson?
Personally, I'd have kept Gylfi Sigurdsson, but we didn't really have an option. He wanted to leave, and when a player wants to leave, you know, you have to sell. And I think we all knew from the end of last season that he had to go, really. But if you were to give me that simple choice, I'd take Gylfi Sigurdsson. The performances early on the season have shown, you know, how everything we do was built around him. And now that he's not there, there's just this literal gaping hole in the middle of the pitch, and you're like, who's going to fill it? And we're lucky now at players to try and replace him, because, you know, it's what we've been saying, because other clubs know that we've got £45 million in the bank and we've only got, what, 2 weeks left to plug that gap. You know, they can just name their price. I think Chadli, we're being linked with Nasser Chadli, and that would cost more than £25 million. Klukas from Hull is another one we're being closely linked with now, and that looks to be costing more than £20 million if we want to go there, which seems
crazy.
That seems absolutely ridiculous for me to pay £20 million for Klukas, because I think he's just your definition of an average player. I think he'll work hard, but you know, he's fine, but nothing more than that. You know, these are the prices that we're being quoted. So the £45 million actually doesn't buy you as much as you'd think it would, really, in a normal market. And we're going to be probably overspending on a replacement anyway, who, let's face it, in all likelihood won't be anywhere near as good as Gylfi Sigurdsson. So, yeah, given the choice, I would have kept him, but it wasn't an option, sadly. I think he was always going to go to Everton. It was just a question of how much we'd be able to get out to them.
Anybody else want to kick in?
Yeah, go on. I completely agree with Gutto there, that the fact that a club like Swansea, very similar to Palace, in that Gylfi was the main man, and yeah, Gutto's already said the fact that there's a massive hole there now, and I completely agree. I'd have kept him rather than the money. I'm not saying he's not worth the money at all, but I think he's more important to Swansea than the money is, because, like we just mentioned, the inflated transfer fees. I mean, who are you going to get anywhere near? You could bring in three players for 45 million, but are they going to do anything like the job Gylfi's done for Swansea in the past few years? Likely it is, probably not, because you're overpaying for people at the moment. It's very similar. I mean, it's a very similar position at Palace, really, in that, you know, you've got a star player or a couple of star players, and if somebody comes in and makes a bid, you know, so close to the start of the season, or even, you know, a week after the season started, and it's so difficult to try and find a replacement for that player that was so effective in the first place anyway. It takes players time to, you know, kind of settle into clubs as well. So it's really difficult. Yeah, definitely Sigurdsson all day long.
All right, Tottenham have been put in a awkward situation with Danny Rose's recent comments about winning titles and not signing players that you have to Google right before they signed Davinson Sanchez, who's only had 1 year at the highest level in the Netherlands. Seems like things have been patched up there, but Chelsea allegedly were interested in offering $50 million for him. Which would you rather have?
I'd take the money all day with Danny Rose. I really would. I do think he's obviously a very good defender, but if you can get the same for Danny Rose as you got for Kyle Walker, who for me is a much better defender, physically suits that kind of modern fullback role because he's built like a tank compared to Rose, who's a lot slighter. And yeah, they're both pacey, kind of attack-minded fullbacks, but 50 million for me, again, I just think with the way that Spurs have faith in their youth system and are set up, you know, in that particular situation and their ability to potentially source some players, I appreciate it's difficult and it looks like this Sanchez deal is going to be an expensive one in the grand scheme of things, considering what he's done. But they've got this history of being able to A, nurture youth talent or find a relatively underpaid, underrated player in the market. Then I'd completely trust my scouting team to find me someone that was at least as good either in the youth ranks already or and develop them, or to find someone for less than 50 million, I'd say.
I'd go along with that. I'd sell Danny Rose for 50 million, I think. Again, brilliant player, nobody's denying that, but I it's another position where I think he is largely replaceable for Spurs. I think, you know, I'm a huge Ben Davis fan. I think he's ridiculously underappreciated, how good he is, and I think he'd be able to do a very good job for Spurs, even if he's a slightly different player to what Danny Rose is. And the only danger for Spurs is that they start, you know, the other players start looking at Walker leaving, Rose leaving, and thinking, you know, should we be thinking about this too? That's the only thing I'd be worried about from a Spurs point of view. But I think what Spurs could do with 50 million for a player who is not absolutely key to everything they do, I'd accept it straight away.
Yeah, I agree with you guys. Take the money for sure. I think Danny Rose is slightly overrated. I don't know if that's controversial or not, but I find him as a defender causes more problems perhaps than he should for a fullback, you know, because of the way he plays, his manner, makes stupid decisions. And again, the guy's already said he's in a position where it's replaceable rather than a position that creates something going forward, particularly. And after what he said in the press, you know, about Spurs, you know, his mind is obviously set to go elsewhere. And I think you find it difficult to keep a player at the club who's come out and been such outspoken in that manner. Interesting to know what the change room's like when he comes. Well, he probably won't play for Spurs again, I wouldn't have thought. But I would certainly take the money.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. He did apologize, and Pochettino has said it's in the rearview mirror, but apologies do not unsay those words.
Exactly.
But yeah, it'll be interesting to see. Any other examples that you guys want to throw out to the group?
I've got one.
Yep.
Riyad Mahrez, 40 million, or Oof. Keep him.
I think
for once, it's I'm going to say it. I'm a bit biased, obviously, because I watch Riyad a lot, but I think 40 million for him is a fair price. I think it's a fair price for both.
So you'll take it?
I think we're going to have to, because I think he wants to leave. He's made that very, very clear. But I also feel like we're not overcharging anybody at 40 million for a player that won the PFA Player of the Year award 2 years ago and has clearly shown he can do it on a Champions League stage. I think when you look at some of the prices that are being quoted for your, you know, going back to Gutter's replacements for Gylfi Sigurdsson, and the amount of money that you're being quoted for your likes of Sam Clucas or your Etienne Capoue's, Riyad Mahrez is a cut above either of those players by a significant margin. Sure. He's an absolute baller and capable of producing it on the highest possible stage. So actually, 40 million. I'm surprised we haven't had more suitors. I think it's purely his attitude or lack thereof. And his application that has stopped other clubs coming on for him. But I think he's a prime candidate for a deadline day 40 million pound bid from someone like a Liverpool, a Chelsea, or even Roma. Obviously, they've been sniffing around for a long time. But either one of those English clubs, if they feel like they need reinforcements at the last minute and they know they can get him for 40 million, I think he's going to be really popular come the end of the month.
I'd say that the fact that you call that a fair price probably suggests that it's not worth taking. I think clubs would be willing to pay a little bit more for Mahrez. I think in this market, clubs have a responsibility to just absolutely try and fleece.
Absolutely.
and so I'd say, yeah, don't know, 50 million for someone like Mahrez, who I know he's been in and out of form since You know, since Leicester won the title, you know, he's maybe not reached the height they did, particularly in the first half of that season. But still, you know, he's capable. He's got the talent to do it for a Champions League team. I think in the modern market, yeah, clubs, they've got money to burn. They can fork out a little bit more on Mahrez, in my opinion. I think Leicester be missing a trick selling him for 40 million when they could get just that tiniest bit more.
I've got one for you guys. I can't remember the exact fee that's been touted for. I think it's about between 80 and 21 million. But Johnny Evans to Man City.
Interesting. That is such an intriguing thing, largely because City would be sending money to United.
I'll just put in on this before everyone gets stuck in as well, because Leicester have a kind of a piece in this puzzle, I guess. So we had a bid turned down for Johnny Evans of 10 million earlier on this transfer window, when we were looking at a centre-back replacement and ended up going for Harry Maguire, who I'll talk about later, but looks a gem. And we ended up paying 17 million, I think, for him. But we went for Johnny Evans for 10 million, and that was deemed to be our kind of breaking point. So how mad is it that 4 or 5 weeks later, a club are now looking at spending upwards of double that on him purely because they can't acquire their first, second, third, fourth or fifth choice centre-back target? It's opportunism at its absolute finest by West Brom. And I absolutely don't blame them because he's their captain. But I just think it's brilliant how, because Man City are interested, their asking price is probably doubled, if not more. And even then, they're still standing firm because it's the end of the transfer window.
It's interesting because we're in a similar dilemma with Sacco from Liverpool. In that I know that we've made a couple of bids for him. Liverpool want 30 million for him. We don't want to pay 30 million for him. The interest has cooled a little bit. And I think it's a bit of a game at the moment, because the longer you leave it, Liverpool clearly want to get rid of Sacco. Nobody else has come in for him. So it's that waiting game, isn't it? To see, you know, you've got less than 2 weeks to go to a transfer window. It's literally 2 weeks, isn't it? You know, do Palace call Liverpool's bluff and just leave it and throw in a bid, you know, in the last few days of the transfer window in an effort to try and get him? Because I have to say, you know, he was fantastic for us in those 8 games he played for us before he got injured. And it's a very similar scenario that, you know, he's never going to play for Liverpool again. There's no doubt about that at all, because he's had a bust up with Klopp, even though he's their best centre back at the club. It's absolutely ludicrous how people can't get over, you know, crosswords or whatever's happened. So it'd be interesting to see how that is. We have cooled our interest, I know, whether that's down to the money or what. I'll be interested to see if we go back for him, but seems another crazy situation.
If you can get him at 30, I say take it, because we just spent reportedly somewhere between 28 and 32 on a 20-year-old centre-back.
But this is the thing, it's a value thing. How valuable is he to us to bring him in? 27-year-old centre-back who clearly isn't wanted by Liverpool, but made such an impact for us last season. It was close to being named our player of the year just for playing those 8 games. How crazy that might sound to opposition fans, he was that good. He made that much of a difference. And, you know, we shelled out already 30 million for Benteke. You know, 30 million isn't an amount of money that Palace are comfortable or used to throwing at players. And while fans keep saying, yeah, we get a lot of money from the Premier League, you know, it's a salary as well. It's everything that goes with it. So, and I'm guessing Swansea would be in a very similar, you know, scenario in the, you know, how many £30 million players do you, you know, can you financially bring to a club like, you know, like ours? So it's a difficult one. All the fans want him to come. Yeah, like you just mentioned, Kev, you know, you spent a lot more on a player, which, he's only had a year at a top level. Which interests to see how he goes. But Sacco's proven, you know, he's proven at the very top level. And I find it astounding that Liverpool can't find a place for him, because he's clearly their best defender. You know, a position that they struggle with. They've struggled with that position
horribly,
for years.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's ridiculous. But the commanding a £30 million fee at the moment is just pushing, I think will push us, you know, a little bit too far. But we'll see.
All right, well, we are going to take a quick break, and then we'll come back with specific questions for each of our guests regarding their clubs.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
All right, and we are back. Jim, we'll lead in with you. Leicester arguably should have gotten more out of match week one against Arsenal. Jamie Vardy was absolutely flying. Mahrez, who we've already discussed, was having a good game as well. And Maguire, who you already discussed and said you will discuss again later, was vital in that one as well. But you don't get the 3 points. You do get them this week. Where do you think you're going to land this year? Is the truth kind of in between there? Or it's just hard to tell. Because as we were saying with Mahrez, how his form kind of came in and out, so did Leicester's last year, having won the title the year before. I think it's just very hard for neutrals to pin down how good or what we can expect from Leicester.
I think it's quite difficult for us as fans to pin down what we expect as well. Like, I think, yeah, we were unlucky against Arsenal. And I think if you look at their result against Stoke this weekend and just how few kind of clear-cut chances, yeah, they had one ruled out for offside, which was marginal, but they weren't creating the kind of amount of chances against a Stoke team who aren't a million miles away from Leicester in the table and probably won't be that far away from us in the table this year. So you can kind of feel unlucky that they created enough to beat us 4-3. And you're always disappointed whenever you score three times and you don't get anything from the game. That said, like I said, we were particularly good against Brighton. We didn't have to be that good. I think that's the key to take out of that. That Brighton are clearly struggling, I think, to adapt to the Premier League. That doesn't mean that I think they'll be relegated this year. I think there's plenty of time. But I would be concerned if I was a Brighton fan at how little they created. I know they've got players coming in, and I know their new record signing wasn't able to play against us. So that may change things in the final third for them. But we're in that weird group of teams where you expect not to be battling against relegation despite what we had last year. I think with no Champions League this year and the squad that we've got, we should be relatively kind of, I don't think we'd be out of our realms in saying we don't want to be battling against relegation or anything close to it. But we're also not going to challenge, you know, the Evertons that have spent 150 million this year to even go close to a top six place. We're probably just going to end up 8th or 9th or maybe 10th, something like that, which would be seen as an improvement because it's obviously building on last year. And I think we'll take the domestic cups a bit more seriously this time around because of a lack of Champions League. So you've got those kind of midweek spots where you can afford to be more aggressive in the League Cup and the FA Cup when that comes around in the new year. So I think we're just going to end up mid-table in a cup run. It sounds cliched because I feel like that's what every team would want. And I feel like Palace and Swansea potentially are saying the same thing. You know, probably too good to be involved in a relegation battle. Look at mid-table, look at the cups as an option, as a kind of potential source of enjoyment for the fans, as well as a relatively safe mid-table finish. But ultimately, that's probably the ceiling of what any of us are going to do because, you know, yeah, we won the league 2 years ago, but that is probably never going to happen again in any of our lifetimes. And it was such a freak season that it's just going to kind of return to norm, if you like. All these teams around you are spending tens of millions just like you are, so you'd probably think there's going to be some levelling out there and we're probably going to finish 10th, I'd say.
Fair enough. On to you now, Gitto. This has not been the window you would have liked, especially the Sigurdsson deal being done so late. Do you think you're going to reinvest, and what do you think about the names of like Joe Allen and Wilfred Bony being linked to the club? Because from an external perspective, that kind of seems like looking backwards to look forwards.
You're right in saying it's not been what we'd hoped for. You know, we may have expected Gylfi Sigurdsson to leave, but the way it's gone about it, it's just distracted everybody and really just stopped us from doing any other kind of business. And we're now in the situation where our best player has just left us. We're really, really struggling without him to create anything. And we've only got 2 weeks to bring people in, and the names that we've been linked with, I'll be honest, that they're pretty unimaginative and they're likely to cost a lot of money. I mean, Joe Allen is one, you know, it, the other thing is a lot of the names we've been linked with are not necessarily positions that we really need. Joe Allen is a brilliant player who I absolutely love, but we don't really need that deeper midfielder at the moment. And if we're looking for a number 10, I think there's better out there than Joe Allen, even though he has been playing that position for Stoke and has had reasonable success there. Same thing goes with Wilfred Bony. I mean, differently with Bony, he's been off form for 2 years. So there is a big risk if you're going to spend a couple of million on him, expecting him to score goals. He's going to need quite a lot of help to get back to the player he was. No guarantees they would. And again, it's in a position where actually we're quite well stocked. Fernando Llorente is going to come back from injury, and I'm hoping that we wouldn't be wanting to sell him this late in the window, having already lost Gylfi. Tammy Abraham has shown some really good flashes since joining. It's just that he's not received any kind of service so far. The big question is that number 10 position. And yeah, the names that we've been linked with aren't particularly inspiring at the moment. Talking about Nasser Chadli for upwards of 25 million. Sam Clucas from Hull, again, more than 20 million being linked with. So a huge chunk of the Gylfi Sigurdsson money is going to be spent on a vastly inferior player to replace him in his position. And it's a move that the club have to get right, really, because we've had in our first two games of the season one shot on target. And we haven't actually looked like scoring at any point in our first two games. Defensively, we've actually been okay. I know we lost 4-0 to United, but that did come when we really chucked everybody forward and left gaps at the back. Up until that point, we were contained them pretty well. So no real concerns about defensively at the moment. All the concerns are in attack, where we look completely toothless, completely unimaginative, and we're just waiting for that player to come in who's going to change everything. But there is going to be a lot of pressure on that player's shoulders, because not that, you know, I want to overstate it or anything like that, but they need to be the new Gylfi Sigurdsson, and that's going to be difficult.
You mentioned how unimaginative a lot of these options you're looking at are. Do you think that's the manager not giving the right list of names to the scouting team? Is the scouting team not coming up with enough people on their own, or is ownership not as willing to endorse purchases of players that are less well known?
I just don't know what our scouting department does, if I'm honest. We used to be so good in this department back when we were in the lower leagues, you know, when we were in League One getting Premier League quality players on the cheap to join us. Players nobody had ever heard of but turned out to be absolute stars. And the same thing was in the Championship, and of course when we first joined the Premier League. But for the last few years, the players we've been bringing in, they've been really just underwhelming. We've overpaid on a lot of them, and they haven't been as good as the players that have been leaving the club. All the players that we've been linked with at the moment, apart from Clucas, are ones that we've been linked with in the past or who have played for the club in the past. So you have to look at the scouting system there and ask, you know, what are you being paid to do? Why are there no new names coming up? Do you actually keep an eye on other European leagues and see what's going on there? Because there's just no imagination at all. No real outside the box thinking going on, and it's going to cost us a lot of money, and it's going to leave us with probably players who, we could have done better than, if I'm honest.
Yeah. Jay, Crystal Palace also not had the best start to the season, which has caused a lot of this Frank de Boer and how it started at Inter narrative stuff. I feel like that's a pretty uninventive way to go with this. So I'm curious if you have seen any positives in the shift in tactics and formation, if there are things that you can see where you can see the direction it's going, but maybe it's just not there yet, whether it be due to personnel or comfort with the system.
I think it's a real mix, actually. Frank de Boer's come in, he's said all the right things. It's an exciting appointment, but a little bit daunting in the fact that it's far removed from what we normally go for as a club. So there is a big change in the style. The formation is the main thing that's been talked about a lot in the media and by fans. Opening day was a disaster, a complete disaster. I mean, it's never easy to play a newly promoted side off the back of a promotion, particularly through the playoffs. That, you know, the team is on a high. They played six new signings, and they really gave it to us big time. I mean, to be fair, David Wagner, even though they won the game, he did actually say that, you know, the score wasn't a true reflection on the game. You know, we had a fair few chances, we just couldn't put ball in the net. But regardless, they beat us 3-0 fair and square. And that was perhaps a wake-up call to the fact that, you know, it's a harsh reality, the Premier League, and it was a very harsh debut for Frank de Boer. But in pre-season, you know, he's implemented a style of football which he's done it throughout the club, you know, from the youngest academy side all the way through to the first team. And that's what he did. That's quite common with European clubs. See, a lot of European clubs do that. Ajax, for one, you know, did it when he was working in the academy, and obviously he ended up managing the first team and having all the success there. You mentioned the debacle at Inter, which, you know, that is probably the downside in appointing De Boer and thinking, you know, that was after the Ajax job that he, you know, did very successfully. And you do question how strong the Dutch league is. But Ajax are a massive, massive side, you know, won an awful lot of things. And he did very, you know, exceptionally well with them to win, I think it's four titles.
In a row.
I think when you read into the Inter situation, his hands were fairly tied. I think he joined the club a couple of weeks before the season started. They had injuries, they had a takeover as well. Lasted 90 days, haven't won a game for 12 games or something like that, or just a bit less, and parted ways. So, yeah, in the back of your mind, it kind of sits there. But, you know, since De Boer's come in, he had a whole pre-season. He was you know, at the club when the players came back for pre-season training, so he's had a lot of time with them. He's implemented the system throughout the club, which is, you know, it's changing things, and I think that will take a little bit of time. I know the Premier League doesn't give you a lot of time because it's, you know, harsh reality, and it's a tough division. No game is easy. It's, you know, it's all those old cliches, but it's true. You know, a lot of fans expected us to, you know, to see off Huddersfield quite easy in that first game, and, you know, having seen Palace and been a Palace fan for years, and having been a fan of football for years, you know, you do get odd results on opening days. You've seen that so often. And I'm not saying it's odd results. That was taking away the result from Huddersfield. But they went and beat Newcastle today, who came up with them. You know, I think it'll take time for teams to work out Huddersfield. It happened with Blackpool when they came out. It happened to Hull before that. You know, I think last season they were top four after a few games. You know, I firmly expect them to be struggling towards the end of the season, as things go, because, yeah, different things happen throughout the season. But, you know, when it comes to Palace, I think the impressive thing was the reaction by the players yesterday at Liverpool. I think we frustrated Liverpool for large parts of the game. I think the formation perhaps lended itself a bit more to an away performance, rather than having the 3-4-3 formation. It ended up being kind of a flat back five in a way, you know, more often than not. But obviously, you know, the wing backs bombing forward whenever needed to go forward. But we did frustrate Liverpool. A lot of people expected us to get absolutely hammered at Liverpool yesterday, and it didn't happen. And you know, if it wasn't for Benteke missing a great chance he had before Liverpool scored, I mean, fantastic work by Ruben Loftus-Cheek. I mean, he's been fantastic in both of those games, but he worked a really good chance for Benteke, and he blazed it over from 6 yards out. And if that chance had gone in, it may have been slightly different. But take nothing away from, you know, the performance. Other than for a mistake, and which Liverpool scored from, it was a really close game. And yep, Liverpool had chances, but yeah, Hennessy was in inspired form. And, you know, I've been openly critical of Hennessy in recent seasons, but he was absolutely fantastic yesterday. My man of the match for sure. So a lot of positive signs from the game yesterday. It will take time for this system to be implemented. But my only problem is that I find it difficult how professional footballers that get paid so much money and been playing the game for so long find it so difficult to change the system. Maybe that's me not understanding, you know, quite what goes on. But I know Palace have had a formation for the last 3 or 4 years in the way that they've played, and the personnel at Palace have been, you know, the main parts of the first team still remain, you know, have done for a number of seasons now. So maybe that's a problem. But disappointing loss on for the opening day, but very promising yesterday, and it's I'm excited about the season, even if it hasn't started so well, because I think Frank de Boer's a breath of fresh air. Obviously, you know, fingers crossed that the gamble, as it perhaps could be called, is, you know, will work for us. But I think it's a bold move to try and change things from what we're particularly used to. And I think one of the big things is that he's trying to bring some youth through, and that's not happened at Palace for an awful long time. Wilfred Zaha's probably the last youth player that really has really made it into the first team for us. But pre-season, we saw a lot of youth team opportunities, youth academy players coming through into to play in pre-season. A youngster called Jason Lukilo, he played against Schalke in our final pre-season game, and he was given all the set pieces to take in that game, which is a bold move. But Frank de Boer has been out with the academy teams, managing the academy teams in some of their friendlies as well, which again is a breath of fresh air, because I hadn't seen any manager do that before, a first team manager go and do that. So while it's you know, a bit of hesitancy after the first couple of losses, you know, kind of fingers crossed that it will work out, but it's going to be interesting to see how it pans out.
Yeah, just a note on when you were saying why it would take so long to change tactics. I often like to think of it as learning a new language, where it's not difficult to learn a lot of the words in their own separate context. The issue is fluency and starting to think in that system instead of just knowing how you should fit into the system. I think there's a difference there between knowledge and understanding and making sure that it's your initial reaction. Because even if you're a split second late, like, oh, what am I meant to do here? I used to do this. You take that step, and now somebody's cut back on your outside foot. Now you're exposed. Anyway, just how I...
That's a fair point. I mean, watching a Huddersfield game, it was clear that we struggled to play that formation at home, you know, with three centre-backs and the two wing-backs going forward. And watching that game, it was clear that it was going to be a better formation for us to use away from home. And so it proved against Liverpool. It's just knowing how to use it in an offensive formation. Like, you have to be at home. The onus is on the home team to kind of take the game to the away team, because the away team generally come and try and close you down, defend a bit more, and hit you on a break, as what Huddersfield done very early on in that game, as it turned out. But our home form's been terrible the last couple of years anyway, so that's no surprise. But you know, it's going to be interesting. I'm hoping he's given enough time to see how it works, but obviously, you know, time doesn't really happen in the Premier League or in football at all, does it? So we'll have to see.
Yeah, well, I'd just like to make it known that I am not hiding here, so if anybody has any questions for me that hopefully don't involve the words Wembley, that would be delightful.
And how did Spurs get on, Kev, today?
You know, not great result-wise, but one of the reasons why I'm so frustrated with this whole Wembley narrative, well, first of all, Poch beautifully dismantled it at the weekend, where he talked about growing up in Argentina, he always dreamed of playing at Wembley, and if the players can't figure out how to play there, it is not on Wembley, it's on the players. And I think that showed. I think there are far too many parallels, unfortunately, between this loss to Chelsea at Wembley and our last loss to Chelsea at Wembley, where we dominated play. We had the majority of the shots, we had the majority of the chances, we had the majority of the corners, but it just doesn't come to anything. And I saw some Spurs fans saying that we were the better team today. And it really got me thinking on what makes a team better? What do people mean when they mean better? Because Chelsea did not have four of their regular starters available. Their best ability is to defend, and so then they did that. So, I mean, yes, Tottenham looked better, I suppose, and that we were constantly in attack. We were constantly threatening. We were getting in between the lines well, but they did what they were trying to do, defend and keep us from scoring, better than we did what we were supposed to do, which was to score. So at a certain point, and I tweeted this out right after the match, at a certain point, these moral victories have to become actual victories. We've had this a lot under Poch, where we know that we've played well. But at a certain point, that wears too thin. And I think we're starting to get there. Wembley is not even a factor for me. It is a continuation of our struggles, specifically against Chelsea, especially in cups.
It was a good game, though.
It was. It was a very good match. And I think the frustration from a lot of Spurs fans is based on history more than it was this specific match. But I also think trying to high road against Chelsea and saying, oh, well, we were actually playing football. They couldn't actually play football. They had four youth players on their bench today. They never wanted to come out. They started six defenders. Like, I don't know why people are surprised that the stats leaned in our way when they had no intention of coming out and playing football. But if they had come out to play, we probably would have beaten them like we did in the 2-0 last year in the Premier League. So I think Conte, despite me disagreeing with his weird reaction to the Costa stuff on Friday, I've always respected him as a manager. I think what he did with Italy was fantastic at the last Euros. Obviously, his time at Juventus was fruitful. And in 1 year, he won a Premier League title. I think he addressed this game the way he wanted to. And I think that we somewhat naively played into that. Now, if Kane's curled shot hits the back of the net instead of the post, then it's a whole different game, right? If you score that first goal, it changes the whole complexion. But we didn't. And playing in the world of what-ifs can become a very dangerous proposition in the long run. But I'm still confident for the season. Losing today doesn't mean we're going to get relegated or even miss top four. We've waited late in the window to sign players, which we know Poch doesn't like, but we know Levy does like. There's some internal issues there that we probably need to address in the long term. But all in all, not too frustrated. Obviously, the way it happened was gut-wrenching, but you learn from it, you pick up, you move on. I'm not even interested in the Wembley stuff. If we struggle in our next few ones at Wembley, maybe bring that up. But we've basically exclusively played difficult teams at Wembley because we played there in the Champions League and then in the semi-final of the FA Cup last year. So this narrative has always fallen flat for me. But anyway.
Do you think, Kev, the game today was different because of Chelsea's loss last week, that they had to come out and get a result no matter what today? I know you said they set up defensively, but do you think that perhaps hindered the way you would have played the game normally? If Chelsea had won the game last weekend, then do you think things might have been a bit different?
Well, yeah, things would have been very different. First of all, if that game had been going well for Chelsea, they would have had Gary Cahill and Cesc Fabregas available.
Yeah, that's true.
Which obviously changes a whole lot of stuff. Yeah. But I mean, you never want to play a big team after a big loss. You always fear that kind of you clip them in the tail and you get the teeth next kind of situation. But the mentality part, sure. I mean, Chelsea obviously did not want to lose 2 weeks in a row, especially after the way they lost to Burnley, which was even before Cahill got sent off. I think Burnley were the better team in that one. It was unfortunate. Once you start opening that what-if box, it can go a lot of places. But I will say, like I said before, if they had come out to attack openly, I think we win that match. Because our biggest issue is breaking down teams that want to defend. And unfortunately, there's been an increase in the amount of teams that are willing to do that. And that's Pochettino's job. And if he is the manager of quality that we all think he is, being nominated for Coach of the Year this week, then he needs to sort that out. The flexibility we saw today, we played three different formations in the last 15 minutes. I liked that in that in previous years he would have done nothing, so we never would have gotten the equalizer. So we would have just lost 2-0 because they probably would have scored again. But then opening up after the equalizer to score against them is what then allowed them to rescore against us. I trust Poch. I'm not too worried about that. But if Chelsea had come out to attack us from the off, I think we win this match. But they never wanted to, and that was wise on their part.
Just quickly, you mentioned the Cahill sending off last week in the Chelsea-Burnley game. I don't know what you guys think, but that... I mean, that was a red card. Well, it's on borderline red card, wasn't it? But since last weekend, there's probably been four or five challenges in the Premier League which have been worse than that. I mean, Mark Noble just today in the West Ham game was worse than Cahill's. It just seems bizarre that no other players have been penalised for something which, particularly at the start of the season when referees tend to, kind of overdo the rules a little bit, as we saw at the start of last season with some of the shirt pulling. But Cahill probably got the rough end of the deal last weekend when you look at some of the challenges this weekend. Like I mentioned, Noble, a couple of others I saw as well, very similar. I think Huddersfield had one today as well. Tommy Smith, I think it was, against Newcastle. It just seemed a bit odd to me that one player's been clamped down on, but not many others.
I think it's all to do with consistency, isn't it? You just want to see you know, the similar challenges being punished in a similar way. I too thought the Kale one was a red card, but yeah, there have been one or two challenges where I don't think there's been, I can't remember the Noble one off the top of my head, but I can't remember any ones which have gone, they're blatant red and the referee has missed them. But yeah, it's when you see, you know, players lunging in a dangerous way like that, and you're thinking none of these are being punished with a red card. Yeah, it is just a matter of consistency and making sure that all players are punished equally.
It's just how refs interpret the tackles as well, isn't it? It's a split second decision, and it could be, you know, through a crowd of players, or one ref can look at a decision and another ref might have only booked Cahill for that challenge against Burnley. Yeah. I don't think it was a particularly, you know, I don't think it was a horror challenge, but by the same token, I wouldn't have been complaining if he'd have been sent off. If he was, you know, from a Leicester point of view, you look at that tackle and you say, yeah, okay, that's stupid. You give the ref the opportunity to send you off.
Yeah, exactly.
But another ref, you know, you could put that in front of 10 refs, just like you could put it in front of 10 fans. And just because they're paid professional refs doesn't mean that they'll interpret that challenge the same way. The Noble one, I think, is just a miss on the ref's part. I don't know how that isn't. These challenges where both players go into 50-50s, but one goes in a lot higher than the other and ends up smashing into someone's shins, just seem to kind of be, I don't know, just overlooked, I guess, because it's not one player smashing into another that's got his foot planted. But they're pretty dangerous, and you know, there has got to be some kind of accountability there. I think refs have got to be a bit more on the lookout for that. But as we've said before numerous times, you know, I've said it on the pod before, you know, the game moves so quickly now, and I wouldn't fancy being a ref. It's such a difficult job, and you have to be so right all of the time. And yeah, you know, like I say, that panel of 10 refs theoretically could be showing that Cahill tackle 50-50, maybe split, maybe 60-40, but therein lies the problem, that there is no hard and fast rules, and football is a game of interpretations. You know, you look at a lot of other sports where video referees have been applied and they don't have the interpretation element or as many as football. It's just, you know, it's black or white, the ball's over the line or not, or the ball's going to do this or do that, or whatever it is. And I think, you know, even when you do apply video technology, it's never perfect. So it just creates more talking points, doesn't it? I do appreciate that if you're a Chelsea fan looking at that game today without your best central defender, and then you look at the challenges that are going in and saying, well, he's not been sent off for that. But yeah, it's kind of what keeps us coming back, isn't it? And doing things like this and talking about the games, because it creates talking points. And I think, you know, you don't want to sterilise the game so much that you take that out.
Yeah, all right. Well, we are quickly running out of time, but we will still do player watch. Instead of all your new signings, we'll just narrow it down to who you think your best new signing has been and how they've played at the start of the season.
Mine, without a shadow of a doubt, is Harry Maguire, based on the first two games. I know we conceded four at Arsenal. A lot of those, you know, are kind of, a couple of them were quite unlucky, I think, with little deflections and things like that. But he just looks a rock. It will be interesting to see how he copes against better teams. Obviously, we've only played Arsenal and Brighton so far, so we've very much played both ends of the spectrum now. But he looks very assured, very composed, very dominant in the air, which is really important when you're replacing someone like Robert Huth in the back line. And I think, in the, you know, for all the transfer fees we've talked about in the modern market, £17-18 million from Hull City is going to turn out to be a bargain for a player of his ability and his age.
Tammy Abraham's the only new signing that's played both of Swansea's games so far this season. He's shown some promising flashes, some really nice touches, and he's working hard, but still hasn't. Well, he's had one or two chances against Southampton, but it's tough to judge him so far because he just hasn't been receiving a constant supply of chances. So he's looked a little bit frustrated at times when he's 30 yards ahead of the next closest player to him. But so far the signs are promising, and hopefully, you know, we can start putting in some better balls into him, and he can start scoring. Rocky Mesa then started yesterday against Manchester United, and looked very assured on the ball, kind of like the new Leon Britton that we've been looking for years. So hopefully he can continue that and replicate the brilliant form of they showed in Las Palmas.
Well, all three of our new signings have played. Jaro Riederwald, the Dutch defender from Ajax, played the first game at Huddersfield. Didn't play yesterday because of a knock. He struggled a little bit in that first game, unfortunately. But the other two are loan signings. Timothy Fosu-Mensah, who United fans were disappointed to see him go out on loan, actually, from what I've spoken to some of them. And he's been impressive in both games, actually, but he's been outshone by Ruben Loftus-Cheek, who has had... He had a really good pre-season, showed an awful lot about what he's about and how capable he is. And in the two games so far, even though the loss on the opening day, he was very good. But he was exceptional yesterday at Anfield. I mentioned he created a chance for Benteke. Was very frustrated, openly frustrated about the miss. But he's strong, very good on the ball. Got a good eye for a pass, and he did a superb pass in the Schalke friendly, our last friendly at Celeste, where he just picked up the ball, won the tackle, turned, and with the outside of his foot, hit it out wide to Townsend right on the touchline. It was a superb bit of vision. So we haven't had any luck with loan signs from Chelsea, with Patrick Bamford, the first one we had, and then Loic Remy. So fingers crossed. Third time lucky for us with loan signings from Chelsea, and he's looking the business. So hopefully that continue throughout the season.
Yeah, and for Tottenham, we've only half signed one player, who thus far is 0 out of 1 for actual contract signed thus far. So nothing to report from the Tottenham side. Although we do think Devinson will finish signing. And being fully announced tomorrow, and then maybe one or two more to happen already this week. Because, you know, there's only 10 days left, so that's pretty much the remainder of the window. All right, thank you guys so much for joining us. If you'd like to tell people where they could find you or any projects you're working on, now would be a good time.
Thanks for listening, guys. I've been Jim. You can find me on Twitter at JimKnight88. My day job is head of content marketing for a company called Perform, so do a lot of betting-related content on Goal.com and Soccerway. So if betting's your thing, then head over to those and check that out as well.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. And if you want to hear me talk about the Swans even more, then you can go to the podcast's Twitter page, which is at the Jackcast. And we should have a new pod going up over the next few days.
Yeah, great to be back on the podcast. Thanks for inviting me again, Kev. Yeah, I'm Jay. I'm editor of the Eagles Beak, a Palace fan site. I'm normally on the Twitter account there, so it's at the Eagles Beak, and we're all about Palace, but we started pushing out into other parts of football, so head on over, check the website, have a good read.
Yeah, and I am your host, Kevin DeVries, at Kevroff on Twitter. You can listen to our fantasy show that's on this very channel called the FPL Roundtable. Also do fantasy content over at goal.com and for VIP Bet, and now for Fantrax Radio here in the States. So be sure to check those out if you're in those places and are interested in those things. All right, thanks so much for joining us, guys. It's been a pleasure as always, and we hope you keep listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president. You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about...
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.